I'm Benjamin Habib, lecturer in politics and international relations at La Trobe University, and you're listening to a La Trobe University podcast.
Hello everyone, welcome to a La Trobe University podcast. I am Matt Smith, and to set this up for you, a couple of years ago, I went to Paris. Now, it was only a quick visit, but like everyone who goes to Paris, there are a couple of pilgrimages you need to make, especially if you haven't been there before. You need to go up the Eiffel Tower, and you need to go to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa. So I did this. Eiffel Tower, view, very nice, and the Louvre, impressive old art, and there's the Mona Lisa. For such a big build-up, I've got to admit, she was a bit underwhelming. It's a small portrait, it's there behind thick glass, and the room is full of hundreds of people, standing shoulder to shoulder, all trying to get close and to have a good look at a small painting. Impressive, yes, but the entire museum is full of impressive paintings. Everyone wants to get close to this one, taking photos with their cameras, with their phones, even a few people holding up their iPads, even though they were the newest thing at the time. So I got close, had a look, gave a nod, and then went to the back of the room and proceeded to take photos of the entire crowd. I tweeted one, which I'll put on the podcast blog. Just me and 1,000 of my closest buddies checking out the Mona Lisa. Hashtag hype fail. So what is it about the Mona Lisa that makes it so famous? That makes this painting, above all others, such a big part of our culture? Well, that's what this podcast is about today. It's an interview with Donald Sassoon. He's an emeritus professor of comparative European history from the Queen Mary University of London. And this is a man who literally wrote the book on the Mona Lisa.
My interest came about around 1999 when I was writing a much bigger book on culture, and I was intrigued by the phenomenon whereby an artifact of high culture, a masterpiece of high culture in music or painting or something, becomes popularly known, becomes known by people who have no special knowledge or particular interest in that field. And I thought the Mona Lisa was a particularly good example of that, since many people who are not terribly interested in art history or in the Renaissance know about the Mona Lisa and certainly would recognize it immediately, and should they go to Paris, they will not fail to go to the Louvre, and if they go to the Louvre, they will not fail to stop, like hundreds of others, thousands of others, to admire the famous painting. So I asked myself, well, how come? Why that particular painting?
Look, that's one of my questions, actually. Why that particular painting? Why is it so popular? What is it about it that's ingrained itself in our culture?
Well, what I tried to do was to reconstruct the process whereby the painting becomes such an international and global icon. And like most historical questions, there's not a single answer. There's not a simple answer. It's complex. So it's to do with a fairly long historical process. The first thing to be said is that the painting was part of the collection of the King of France, and therefore was one of the very first paintings to be put in the Louvre when the Louvre became a national museum after the French Revolution. So in a way, location, the painting was set in the most important museum in Europe, in what was the artistic center of Europe, namely Paris, as early as the beginning of the 19th century.
Yeah.
It was also painted by someone who was a recognized genius. This recognition came about more in the 19th century than earlier. Leonardo was revered not just because he was a painter, but also because he was a scientist and intellectual, and therefore more special than the other great painters of the Renaissance, say Michelangelo or Raphael. But so far, it's an important painting, and it's in the center of Paris and so on. Then towards the middle of the 19th century, the French intelligentsia had developed the theme of the femme fatale, the castrating mysterious woman who drives men to perdition. And somehow they decided that the Mona Lisa was it. The Mona Lisa was a representative of this femme fatale. They chose the Mona Lisa because they were Parisian intellectuals, because the Mona Lisa was not the portrait of a well-known woman, but an unknown woman, and therefore fantasies could develop more easily with a woman who has no history.
Okay.
You couldn't have these fantasies with the Virgin Mary. Well, I suppose you could, but you know, it's better not. Or someone who has a history behind her. That is one of the reasons why the Mona Lisa was chosen. And this is when the idea that the smile is mysterious and enigmatic came about. Before that, the smile was, no one remarked about the smile being mysterious. She was just smiling a little.
Okay.
There are no references to a mystery connected to the smile. But in about 1850, 1855, she becomes mysterious. Before that, she was just a cheerful housewife. So far, so good. So the French intelligentsia decide that the Mona Lisa is a femme fatale. And that idea is also borrowed by the British, particularly by Walter Pater, who wrote purple prose describing the mystery of the Mona Lisa. But by the end of the 19th century, the painting is still only known by an elite. I mean, there are no tourists except well-off people. The Louvre has few visitors, so one cannot speak of a popular understanding of what the Mona Lisa is. Even though at the end of the 19th century you have a development of a popular press in France, in the United States and in Britain, selling up to 1 million newspapers a day, but there is no reason for them to discuss Renaissance art. These are newspapers, tabloids, we would say now. They talk about crimes. And the luck of the Mona Lisa is that it was stolen in 1911,
yeah, yeah,
by an Italian carpenter who was working at the Louvre. So that caused a flurry of excitement in 1911. And the flurry of excitement was renewed in 1913 when he brought the painting back to Italy and he handed it in to an art dealer who called the police. And so there was a whole affair connected with that. And that, in a sense, the clinching moment where something which had been building up for nearly a century develops, and now people know because it's on their breakfast table with a newspaper. After that, you have further developments. When Marcel Duchamp, the Dadaist painter, decides to mock high art by putting moustaches and a goatee beard on a portrait. In order to mock high art, he's got to choose something which is reasonably well known. And so he chooses the Mona Lisa.
When was this?
1919.
Yep.
And he's the first of many people who use the Mona Lisa to make points, either that it's a normal object or that she's ugly, or that she's beautiful, or that she's something. But it becomes a reference point. Such reference point is enhanced after the Second World War, particularly when have a very special occasion. This is when she goes, I say she, of course it's an it, it's a piece of wood.
Yeah.
But she.
She's okay.
She's okay. She goes global when the French, who are in their periodic bout of anti-Americanism and pro-Americanism, usually it's anti, but in that case De Gaulle thought it would be nice for a change to the Americans, decided to send the Mona Lisa to represent European art to the United States. Jackie and John Kennedy were in power jointly, as it were, as the first royal couple in the history of the United States. And so there was an enormous amount of press interest in the Mona Lisa, and an enormous amount of interest in the United States. 1.7 million people in the cold February winter of New York lined up in order to cast a glance to the Mona Lisa for 20 seconds or so. And 10 years later, the thing was repeated with Japan.
Was it the same reception there?
An even bigger one, because in the intervening 10 years, you had the development of merchandising and so on. So you had all sorts of gadgets. You didn't have fridge magnets in 63, but you had them in 1974. So you have the real popularization of the Mona Lisa. At that stage, the advertising industry will begin to use the Mona Lisa systematically. I looked in the archives of the Louvre, because you have to ask permission to the Louvre to use it, and so there is a whole correspondence about that, is that especially after 1980, almost every week there is a use of the Mona Lisa for some kind of advertising.
Really?
So you could argue that the international advertising industry, yes, tries to use their product by linking it with quality, and therefore with high art and Renaissance, Leonardo, and so on and so forth. But in so doing, they also advertise the Mona Lisa for free. It's the conjunction of all of these factors taken together which, in my view, brings about this extraordinary recognition of the Mona Lisa as the world icon.
What's the strangest thing you've seen her on?
Oh, well, I mean, she's been used to advertise Air India, she's been used to advertise a British condom, she's been used to advertise the chain of hotels called, of course, the Renaissance Hotels.
Yeah.
And on and on and on. It's, you know, it's a constant thing. A printer, by showing, of course, the product of the printer reproducing the features of the Mona Lisa in high quality colors.
Okay, and the Louvre are okay with that? Do they have a standard that they set?
The Louvre charges. They don't do it for free.
I imagine that they charge, but do they have like a limit that they go to, you know?
Well, the one with the British condom, I don't think anyone had asked them, and it was
the British condom
earlier. Yes, Gioconda latex. And
how?
It was only marketed in Spain and Latin American countries, and I've never been able to find out why. An unused condom is kept. I'm glad that it's unused. The unused condom is kept in the archives of the Louvre and in the original box.
Okay, so who was the Mona Lisa? Where did the painting get its name from? And
well, Lisa was her name. She was almost certainly, but nothing is absolutely certain, hence controversies. But I'll give you the most likely story. Lisa Gherardini was the wife of a Florentine merchant called Francesco del Giocondo. So her other name, La Gioconda or La Gioconda, is because of her husband. And he asked Leonardo to paint the portrait of his wife, probably in 1503. We know from bank records that Leonardo was broke at the time. He had to leave Milan in 1499, so he was looking for a job, and so he got this commission. Why on earth it ends up in France, we are not sure.
Yeah.
Maybe it took too long for him to paint it. 4 years is an enormous amount for such a small portrait. In 4 years, Michelangelo had done the whole ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. So maybe the merchant got fed up.
He was trying to get the smile quite right. Probably.
The smile is important because it's quite rare for Renaissance paintings to have smiles. Usually people are serious, but there are lots of smiles in the Renaissance. I mean, you know, it's not such a extraordinarily special thing. What is special is that Leonardo uses a technique called sfumato, which means smoky or something like that, blurred. He blurs the corners of the mouth and the corners of the eye, and so it gives an air of ambiguity, because, you know, we tell the expression of people from a corner of the eyes and the corner of the mouth. Kids know that, and when they draw someone smiling, everything points up, and when someone is sad, everything points down.
Yeah.
So if you have them blurred, it's not quite clear what the expression is. And he deliberately used that to, in a sense, enable the viewer to decide what is it that you want the expression to be.
And what do you think of the theory that it's actually a female version of Leonardo himself?
There are hundreds of these theories, and one can come up with any theory you like by looking at the detail or changing somehow a little bit the positions. I think if Leonardo wanted to do a self-portrait, he would have done a self-portrait.
Yeah.
He did not need to disguise it under a woman.
Well, it depends how tricky he wanted to be. He was into the mirror writing as well, so...
Yeah, but he was. We don't know why he was in the mirror writing phase, because if he wanted to disguise things, it's about the silliest way of doing it. Anyone can hold a mirror up. But I mean, all these things are fascinating. Why? Because we don't like things to be simple.
True.
And so, you know, there is a code, there is a secret. After all, the Da Vinci code, that's part of the story. Everything is plausible. And since for a theory, even a conspiracy theory, to work, all you need is to suggest that it is plausible. So all these things are plausible, but I'm a historian. I need more than a plausible theory.
My
I need some kind
that.
Of evidence and some kind of, you know, historical, empirical backing.
That's Professor Donald Sassoon from the Queen Mary University of London. This interview was originally recorded in November 2008, and he delivered a lecture as well, and there'll be a link to that on our podcast blog. That's at podcast.blogs.latrobe.edu.au. And there's also plenty more to listen to on La Trobe University on iTunes U. I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.